If you'd like to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 21, I'm going to be reading from there in just a second. That'll get you ready for the start of the lesson this morning. There's one announcement that I forgot to get to Nick this morning, and that is in preparation for our series of lessons with Brother Russ Bowman coming up that's going to start a week from today. We've placed a list up on the bulletin board right out here to my right. For those of you who would be interested in hosting Russ for a meal at your home, there's only certain meals that he wanted to have. He wanted to try to be able to regulate his food situation this week. But if you're interested in having him into your home, then please take a gander at the list out on the board and sign up if you are inclined to do so. I know that it's going to be a really encouraging week for us. The meeting is coming at a great time for us. I know that he's going to do a great job, and I'm really looking forward to having the chance to sit back and listen to somebody else, as I'm sure all of you are as well. So it should be a really good week. Our theme this year has been each part doing its part, but in the course of the year, I have not addressed what in a lot of ways is the single largest group of people that come here every week, and that is our kids, those that I will define at least as college age and younger. So I'm calling the lesson this morning, each part doing its part, the kids edition. And I want to talk today specifically to the children of the congregation about the part that you can play in the kingdom. But I want to begin this morning with a passage here in Deuteronomy chapter 21 that may at a first glance seem like a negative passage, maybe an unusual place to begin a sermon about the positive role that children can play in the Lord's work. Let's read this passage here, Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 18. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and though they discipline him, will not listen to them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of the place where he lives. And they shall say to the elders of his city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all of the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Any of y'all getting nervous right about now here? Well, there's a serious point that I want to make on the basis of this passage. We need to understand what's actually taking place here. First of all, we're not talking about a little five-year-old kid who's kind of mischievous, you know, shooting off firecrackers when he's not supposed to. The person in this passage who is punished is a young man who is old enough to get drunk. So we need to understand the kind of level of maturity that we're talking about here in this text. Furthermore, the son in this passage is someone who has proven to be stubbornly rebellious. He will not listen to either parent. You notice that verse 18 says, he will not listen to either the voice of his mother or his father. And it's even though both have tried to correct him. So there is a pattern here of persistent rebellion. In other words, what Moses is saying is this is somebody who has, for all intents and purposes, renounced their family connection and parental bond altogether. And so in light of this, this person's parents bring the case before their peers. That is, the other parents of the community, the other heads of households, or what the Bible here refers to as the elders of the community, and they explain to them what their son has done. I think it's implied here that as the elders of the community hear about this son, that they're going to determine whether or not the parents are correct in their estimation. So there's no unilateral authority here in this passage for parents to simply kill their children, which, by the way, in other cultures and history, parents did possess, but not according to the stipulations here found in the law of Moses. In any event, once the elders of the community here hear, and in my view, come to agree that this son has indeed proven to be someone who has scorn for the authority of his parents. Notice that it says in verse 21 that all of the men of the city were to execute the sentence, and that the reason that is given here is to purge evil from the midst. Again, it's evil that this son has committed, and so that Israel itself will be preserved from his influence. Now, nevertheless, this passage, especially to our ears, does ring extreme, I think. So the question I want you to think about this morning is, why this particular measure in the law? Well, consider this point. When young people do not respect the authority of their mother and their father, more is taking place than simply undermining the authority of their parents. They are compromising the communities that they live in. It's the reason that the elders of the city could verify that this child is a rebellious child, because his gluttony and drunkenness would have been so well known in the community that when the parents bring him before them, they could bear witness to the fact. His partying lifestyle would have been well known throughout the city, and not only that, would have therefore been a threat, a potential threat at least, to being a threat to the example he would set, to a corrupting influence to their children as well. So let me ask you this question. What happens to a society when children do not respect their parents? You don't have to go back and look at this case here in the law of Moses. Just look around in many parts of American society in which there aren't even fathers to disrespect. What are those segments of American society like? Virtually every social pathology that we have in our culture can be attributed to the lack of fathers in homes. Whether you're talking about high school dropout rates, or you're talking about drug use or crime rates or teen pregnancy rates, all of those, poverty, all of those things can be connected to fatherlessness. The point I'm making is that when children do not respect parental authority, when parental authority isn't even there to be respected, it has more of a negative impact than just simply what takes place in the four walls of that home. That has a corrosive impact on the larger community. That's the very reason here that in this passage, according to verse 21, all of the men of the city take part in executing the penalty. Because the actions of this child, this son who is disobedient, affect not only his parents, but the community as a whole. So embedded here in this law, which does sound extreme and maybe even harsh to us, is actually a very important point. Namely, parents actually matter, and children actually matter, and children have a really important part to play. So much so that when kids do not play the part they are supposed to, when they do not honor their parents, when they do not do what God intends for them to do, it creates havoc, not only in their own homes, but it creates havoc in the community itself. So this passage sets for us, I think, a very important principle that I think also we understand intuitively. We see it reflected in daily life. Consider just this hypothetical scenario. Suppose that it is little Johnny's responsibility in his house to take out the trash. It's big Shane's responsibility in his house to take out the trash. But let's suppose it is little Johnny's responsibility in his house. His chore is to take out the trash. But little Johnny doesn't do it. He doesn't take out the garbage like he's supposed to. His parents rely on him to do this. They have longed for the day when little Johnny is big enough and strong enough that he can pick up the bag and carry it out to the curb and put it out to the curb, because it's one less thing they have to worry about, because they're busy working to provide for the family. They've got many other more important things to deal with, and it's great to have one less thing to worry about. And so now little Johnny has that chore, but he doesn't do it. Think about the impact this one episode now is going to have in his home. First of all, he's made life more difficult for his parents. Either because now one of them, in addition to everything else that they have to do, They're going to have to take care of the garbage, or they're going to have to take care of him, or maybe both. In the second place, it's very likely that he's now created some conflict. He's going to have created a certain sense of conflict with his parents, because they're going to be irritated and not understanding, why will my child not do this one simple task that I've given my child to do? And it may very well be that he creates some conflict between mother and father, who disagree as to perhaps how to discipline precious little Johnny, which precious little Johnny is probably a master at learning how to exploit. It's kind of funny how that tends to work out. Not only that, but if little Johnny has a little Jane and a little Susie, if he has little brothers and sisters, he's also created a tremendous negative example. And if they ever see little Johnny get away with it one time, they will create a Supreme Court-like precedent on which to build a case with their parents for all future time in memoriam to try to get away with things that they want to get away with. So now he's created conflict with his brothers and sisters. And on a much more serious level, if a child consistently demonstrates that even though their parents tell them to do something, they refuse to do it, they will not do it, then what they are demonstrating is they do not honor and respect their mom and dad. And I've just got to tell you, if you as a child cannot honor and respect the people who are working to give you something to eat and a place to live and clothes to wear, and who would lay their lives down and die for you, if you can't respect those two people and honor those two people, you're not going to respect anybody else. And if you don't learn to respect them and you're not going to respect anybody else, how do you think life is going to work out for you at school when you have teachers who do not love you like your parents? And you have a job, and your boss will certainly not care for you like your parents. And you are a citizen, and I'll guarantee you, your government will not love you like your parents. How do you think life is going to work out? And so the principle here in this passage, though severe to be sure, is actually stating for us a point that is profound, but at the same time, one that is simple. One that all of us can understand. And that is that when a child does not do their part to honor and respect their parents, it creates an enormous problem in many different areas and levels. And not only that, it creates in the child an enormous sense of harm, a failure to honor and respect God-given authority in the home, which will only create further havoc in their life. Now, if you're old enough at this point to have understood the words, they stoned that kid. So if you're old enough to comprehend these words here so far, you're old enough to kind of follow along here with the sermon, then you're also old enough to turn with me to Daniel chapter 1 and see a positive vision of what it is that you as a young person can do to play your part in the kingdom of God, to be the people that he wants you to be, to use your special talents and abilities. I want you to realize what a special time in life you have before you as a child, and to make the most of this time in your life, and to see it here in the lives of Daniel and his friends. So this book, Daniel, opens in chapter 1 with a historical note, kind of arcane details to us. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. We would call this on our calendar the year 605 BC. And it is the beginning of what we sometimes call the Babylonian captivity, the Babylonian exile. When the people of Judah and Jerusalem start to be carried off hundreds of miles away by a foreign power into captivity. By the way, this captivity will end 70 years later, when another nation takes over, the Persians. And that's mentioned in the last verse of this same chapter with the mention of the Persian king Cyrus, down in verse 21. I would suggest to you that in Daniel chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar decides that the smart thing to do would be to take some of these young Jewish boys back home just as an insurance policy If I take some hostages back home with me, maybe that'll make the Jews less likely to try to resist my rule if they know some of their loved ones are back home in the palace. And besides that, maybe I can retrain, reeducate some of these people and turn them into some diplomats and maybe use them in my service. So he takes some of the young men of the house of the royal family, it says in verse 3, some of the cream of the crop to go back and to be retrained. Now here in just a second, we're going to look at a story that occurs here in chapter 1. But I want to make sure that we understand that the book of Daniel was not given to us just to fill a few pages of like some bedtime Bible stories. This is not just simply Bible story hour. This book has a very important purpose, a very important theme. That theme is found over in chapter 2, where Daniel says this in verses 20 and 21. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. The overarching message of this book is that God is in control of history. That God raises kings and God removes kings. You can see this emphasis on God's sovereignty over history here in chapter 1 because three times it says God or the Lord gave. For example, in chapter 1 verse 2, the Lord gave Jehoiakim king of Judah into Nebuchadnezzar's hand. In verse 9, it says, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. In verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill. So what we're going to read about with Daniel and his friends needs to be read in light of the message of this book. God is king overall. He rules overall. What we're going to see is the story of some young men who play a part. Because God's rule over the affairs of the nations also takes place as he uses people through whom he works out his will. So among these members of the royal family who were taken back to Babylon are four young men named for us in verse 6 and 7. They're not only given an education in Babylonian education, they're not only given a new diet in the Babylonian menu, whatever that might have been like, they're given new names. Names in the ancient world always indicated authority. This is Nebuchadnezzar's way of saying, you belong to me now. Verse 6, among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. For some reason, we know Daniel by his Hebrew name, but we know the other three better by their new Babylonian names. Verse 7, the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel, he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah, he called Shadrach. Mishael, he called Meshach. And Azariah, he called Abednego. So then, as the king takes these young men into his employ, begins to retrain them to basically be in the Babylonian service, the first thing he does is he gives them their new diet as he acclimates them to their new culture. But notice what it says in verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Now, why didn't Daniel want to eat his food or drink his wine? I've been to some countries where I didn't necessarily want to eat. I went to Australia one time. I did not want to eat a kangaroo hamburger. So, I mean, was it like that? You know, was it just like something weird? Well, it seems like it was more to it, right? Because Daniel doesn't want to defile himself. So was it maybe because as a Jew living under the law, he knows that there are certain things prohibited under the law? Well, maybe, but wine wasn't prohibited under the law, and yet he says he doesn't want to drink that. Was it maybe because under the ancient idolatrous cultures, usually the food had been offered to idols? Well, maybe, but later Daniel is willing to eat vegetables, and those would have been dedicated to the ancient pagan gods as well, so I'm not sure that works. Maybe it's just Daniel's way of saying, look, you've taken me from my homeland, you've given me a new name, I gotta draw a line somewhere to protect my identity as somebody who belongs to God, so here's where I'm going to draw the line. I'm not going to eat what you're giving me. Maybe it's just simply that matter. But whatever the specific reason is, it's clear that for Daniel, it's a matter of his loyalty to God that leads him to refuse the king's food. And here is the first point that I want to convey to every child who is here today about the thing that you need to do that is of first and vital importance to do your part. And that is, you must learn to love the Lord with all of your heart. That's what the Bible says the first and great commandment is. To love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That you love God with absolute commitment, such that He controls every part of your life, even what you eat. Daniel was so committed to the Lord that even though he was hundreds of miles away from his parents, no longer under their watchful gaze, could have done anything he wanted to do, he loved God so completely that he would not even eat food if he thought it would somehow defile him and his commitment to the Lord. When you love God with all of your heart, then what that means is this. It means that because you love Him with your entire being, you're so loyal and devoted to Him that if everybody else wants to do the wrong thing, like what happens in chapter 3, when everybody else bows down to Nebuchadnezzar's image, you won't do it because you love God more than everybody else. And in fact, when people come and threaten you and tell you you're going to get in trouble if you don't, people who love God with their whole heart say things like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did in chapter 3:17. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and He will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if it be not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image you've set up. And if you have a heart that loves God completely and thoroughly, then that love will grow and keep growing in your life such that when you are an old man, like Daniel had to have been in Daniel 6, because now the Persians are in charge. So it's 70 years later. And they tell you, Daniel, you can't pray to your God anymore. He continues to pray 3 times, morning, noon, and night, even though they decide to throw him into lions, because he loves God with all of his heart. Everything that you hear in your Bible class, everything that you hear me try to say when I preach, everything that takes place when we assemble to worship, you must understand is ultimately directing you to God. You must love Him with all of your heart. If you love Him with all of your heart, then you will have a sense of your own integrity to do what is right at all times, under all circumstances, regardless of what pressure is ever placed on you. So first of all, learn to love God. Now, there's a second thing that every young man and every young woman here can do. If you notice here in Daniel chapter 1, as he resolves himself not to defile himself in any way, he also displays great deference to all of the king's officials. I just read the first half of verse 8. Notice that it says that the rest of verse 8, therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. In other words, Daniel doesn't say to this guy, well, now let me just tell you something, bub. I'm Daniel. I'm a Bible hero. Someday there are going to be vacation Bible school lessons all about me. They're even going to make up songs about me. There's going to be paintings about me. You just better back off and let me eat what I want. He doesn't do that. He asks permission. And in fact, as you go down through this first chapter, all through the story, you constantly see this sort of respect. He asks permission in verse 8. In verses 11, 12, and 13, Daniel makes a good faith offer to the steward here. And he says, hey, look, I know that you want us to eat this food. I'll tell you what. Give us a chance. Only serve us water and vegetables. We'll see how it goes, and then you make the decision. But at no point is Daniel obnoxious. At no point is he a smart aleck. All through the story, he's very respectful, even though he's committed to serving God. So a second thing that every young person here needs to understand is the example that Daniel himself sets for us here. And that is to respect those who are in authority. Remember, what's the theme of this book? Who is the one who rules over the kingdoms of the earth? Who is the one who's raising and removing kings? It's God. Which means that if you're disrespecting these people, whose will is it that ultimately you're disrespecting? What the Bible teaches is that human authority in the home, your mom and dad, or in the government, are authorities that God has placed. And the respect that we show to them is a reflection of the respect that we are to show to God. And of course, if there are times when these authorities try to insist that we do something that violates God and his word, like in Daniel 3 with bowing down to the image, or in Daniel 6, not to pray anymore. Why, of course, because we love God with all our heart, we will serve him. But if you notice in Daniel 3, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were not pugnacious. And in Daniel 6, Daniel was not rude. They just simply respectfully said, we must serve our God. At no point were they disrespectful. So the second thing that everyone here who is a young person can understand is this. That you can be a person of conviction, loving God, but also understand the importance of learning to respect those who are in authority. Daniel and his friends had unflinching devotion to God. But otherwise in this book, what we see time and again is a record of loyal and clear, respectful devotion, even to these pagan kings that they served, provided that it did not require them to compromise their convictions. That leads me to a third thing that we see here in the story of Daniel. Notice with me verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. Here's the third thing I want you to take away as a young person that you can do to play your part in the work of God. And that is to use what you learn for the service of God. What Daniel 1:17 says is that God gave them learning and skill and wisdom and literature. And throughout this book, Daniel and his friends continue to be promoted to higher and higher levels of service in the administration of these kings, where all of this wisdom they were learning was then used in the providence of God for his purposes. It says in verse 17 that God gifted Daniel with understanding and visions and dreams. Guess what Daniel does throughout the entire book? He explains the meaning of visions and dreams. What I want you to see is that all of the emphasis in chapter 1 about the education of these young men, their training and the development of their skill, is built upon in the rest of the book as they are used by God for his providential purposes. So I want to challenge all of you who are younger people. I want to challenge all of you to be good learners. Now, I'm not challenging you to make good grades, because a lot of you people have learned how to make good grades and you never learn anything. So I'm not talking about making good grades. That's irrelevant to my point here this morning. What I'm talking about is being a good learner. To learn things like, for example, how the English language actually works. And I have an astonishing reason to give to you why it would be a really good idea for you to learn how the English language works. Because when Almighty God chose to communicate and reveal his mind to us, guess how he did it? He did it in nouns and verbs and pronouns, which are now translated in our language. And it kind of helps to know how these little squiggly lines actually work together. And so knowing something about the language actually helps us to learn about Almighty God and his plans and purposes for us. I will tell you this, my granddad, if he made it past the third grade, I don't know it. As far as I know, Pop only got a third grade education. He had to go out, hard scrabble life in Eastern Kentucky, work just to try to make a living back in the early 1900s, and he was a carpenter all of his life. He did not have hardly any formal education at all. But I'll tell you what he knew. He knew that if he was going to learn about God, he needed to read. And he needed to learn how to read, and to read often. And so my pop read all the time. He read his Bible constantly. It wasn't because he was some kind of egghead. It wasn't because he was somebody who was just naturally prone to that way. He loved being outdoors. He was a blue collar guys. But he wanted to know what the book said. And so it's going to help you to at least learn something about how to understand the language that God has written to us. But I mean more when I say to learn than just simply these academic things, because not everybody is oriented toward that. Some of you in your life are going to engage in beautiful acts of service for other people. But those acts of service require certain skills and trades that you need to learn. Maybe to care for somebody who is sick. Maybe to build a wheelchair ramp for somebody who is homebound or shut in. I'm just saying to you that right now you are at a point in life where your brain is a little bit more agile than some of us enjoy right now. And you need to take advantage of this moment in life and learn skills, learn trades, learn what you can in whatever your particular talent and aptitude is. But all with the mindset that you love God with your heart, and whatever you learn that can help you be a better person, you will then channel to use for His glory and for His service, which is exactly what Daniel and his friends did in this book. So, I have a brotherly challenge for my young brothers in group 5. I have an observation to make. Could be unfair. I have very limited perspective. I'll just tell you what I see, and you can do with this as you wish. But in my experience here so far, I see in group 5 some young sisters who demonstrate great interest in the Word, who are extremely attentive. I mean, they will actually, and this is just so hard to imagine, they take notes sometimes during lessons. So hard to even fathom this takes place in this modern age, so forth, with technology. That's how interested they are. Some of them even go to the elders and say, "What more can we be doing for the Lord's work?" That's what I've seen. And I think it would be great if the young men were taking the lead in the initiative as digging into the Word as students and focus and asking what they could do for the kingdom. After all, God has designated in His Word that men are to be the spiritual leaders in the home and the church. And that does not happen by accident. It only happens intentionally. It's going to happen when you decide as a young man that you love God with all your heart and you want to develop who you are as a person to carry out the intention that God has given to you, to grapple with the task and challenge God has ahead of you, and strive to better yourself so that you can meet that. That's my challenge for you. If I'm right, well, that's a miracle, but if I'm right, then I challenge you to take up the gauntlet, and if I'm wrong, then prove me wrong. And that's an old preacher tactic to manipulate you either way. Now, for those of you who are younger than group 5, if you're still awake, and actually there's a few of you who are still, I think the stoning thing really got to you this morning. That was kind of like my plan here. So for those of you who are younger, I was trying to think, what could I do to come up with something to take away from this lesson? And it's so hard, you know, when you're trying to preach, and you got all these age groups here, and you try to think, what would be something to give as a takeaway for the kiddos here? So I wanted to come up with something I thought you could remember and stick with. So I came up with a rhyme. I'm not the world's greatest poet. Just ask Christy. I'm not a great poet. But I came up with something, and parents, if you could help me out, would you repeat this with me and maybe elbow your little munchkins there and have them repeat this with me, all right? Something I thought about to encourage the kids that would summarize the basic takeaway of the lesson. All right, so here we go. I will love God. I think we can do better. I will love God. With all my heart. Honor mom and dad. And do my part. And you know, I was thinking about it. I was trying to figure out what in the world am I going to do for these little kids here, try to give them something. So I fussed and fretted about it and wrote this down. And then I kept looking at it and I thought, well, you know, it's actually not a bad thing for me to repeat every day. Maybe change that third line there to honor Christy. But other than that, I think it'd be a pretty good thing for me to be reminded. Do my part. Well, I hope that you'll be encouraged by the story of Daniel and his friends. You know, they were exiles. We're all sort of in that boat. We're all exiles. But even then, it's still possible to love God with all your heart and remain undefiled. And to be respectful, even in very difficult circumstances, and to develop yourself, your skills, your abilities, your trades, your strength, to be channeled for the work of God and do things for the kingdom, to do your part. I hope that you'll be encouraged to do that, whatever age you are. Whether you're Daniel at the start of this book, maybe a young man in junior high school age, or whether you're Daniel at the end of the book, maybe in his 80s, facing the end of life with courage and hope that God will deliver you. Whatever we can do for anyone here this morning to follow Jesus Christ, you let us know by coming forward while we stand and sing.